Welcome to the Etruscans Google Interactive slide presentation. The first artwork we're going to take a look at is the Tomb of the Triclinium. Go ahead and move to slide one and we'll go ahead and get started. So the first view you have is a little bit of context. So you can get a sense of, before we go inside of the tomb, what the exterior looks like. So you guys know from the beginning of this lecture that we did together that the Etruscans were obsessed with the afterlife. But the belief was that the afterlife is just like life on Earth. It's just life in a different place. And so what you're looking at is the necropolis of Monterazzi. A necropolis is the city of the dead. So what that means is there would be like tombs, burial sites. This would be a large site that had a variety of funerary type monuments, tombs, places. And that's basically all we have left of the Etruscans. Everything that we're taking a look at is something that was found in one of a few necropolis sites in Italy. So the first image you have are kind of what looks like little mini huts. And the Etruscans did cremate their dead. Even though they used sarcophagi, which you'll see in a later artwork, they cremated their dead and they put them into sarcophagi or the type of burial mounds that you see here. The center picture you have is what it looks like when you would descend into one of the tombs. And the picture on the right is the exterior of a tomb. There would be many, many tombs, and so they didn't exist in isolation. And so the picture on the right, I think, gives you a good impression of how these little setups for the tombs were organized, because it was intended to emulate kind of like the structure of a city, like neighborhoods. That's how the tomb were placed. So let's go ahead and take a look at the tomb that's in the 250. So we have on slide two, elaborate funerary rituals. So funerary contexts constitute the most abundant evidence we have for what's left of the Etruscan civilization. The elite members of the Etruscan society participated in very elaborate funerary rituals that varied and changed according to both geography and time. The city of Tarquinia, which is where the necropolis of Monterazzi is located, is one of the most powerful and prominent Etruscan centers. And it's known for its painted chamber tombs, as you can see on the image on slide two. And so the significance of these wall paintings is it kind of tells us a story about important information or stories or ideas that connect to Etruscan funeral culture. And it also gives us some insight into how Etruscan society lived. As an advanced Iron Age culture, the Etruscans amassed wealth based on Italy's natural resources, which at that time, in the area the Etruscans came from, would have been rich in metal and mineral ores. They exchanged through medium and long-range trade networks. And so the Tomb of the Triclinium was the name given to an Etruscan chamber that dated around 470 BCE. Chamber tombs are subterranean rock cut chambers accessed with a very easy approachway, as you saw in an earlier slide. The tombs are intended to contain not only the remains of the deceased, but also various grave goods or offerings deposited along with the deceased. The Tomb of the Triclinium is composed of a single chamber with wall decorations painted in fresco. So fresco is the kind of paint that's applied with plaster. So it's pigment or some type of natural mineral, and that mineral will be ground and crushed up and mixed with plaster. So instead of being painted like in a really liquidy form like we imagine most paint, fresco would be a little bit more like putty, stucco-like, and it would be applied to the wall. So this was discovered in 1830, and the tomb takes its name from the three-couch dining room of the ancient Greco-Roman Mediterranean known as the Triclinium. So what we see, essentially, on the rear wall, which is a picture that you guys can see, it's the only picture on slide two, is you're seeing a picture of the rear wall of the tomb. And what you see in that picture is a scene of banqueters enjoying a dinner party. So banqueters would have been like reclining either on some kind of like couch-like piece of furniture, like you'll see in one of the final artworks we look at, the sarcophagus of the spouses. But you'll also see people kind of in movement, dancing, playing instruments. It's intended to be a scene that's a little bit lively. So it is possible to draw stylistic comparisons between the figures that are dining on couches and pottery that the Etruscans imported from Greece. So think back to the pottery like Niobe's crater. That was actually found in an Etruscan tomb. And so that provides evidence that the Etruscans were in regular contact with the Greeks and also valued their objects. And because they bought them, they were probably stylistically influenced by those. So the original fresco painting you see now is only partially preserved. You can see that there's some areas of the wall where the fresco has fallen off, and you can see kind of blank areas. Although it's likely there was originally three couches in this banqueting scene, each hosting a pair of reclining diners, probably one male, one female, two attendants, maybe people meeting the needs of the diners. What we can see is that the diners are dressed in bright and sumptuous robes, and that would have been befitting to their presumed elite status. This is a rock-cut tomb. There are different little burial mounds that I showed you guys on an earlier slide. So this would have been evidence that there are more elite spaces to bury more elite people. And so let's go ahead and move to slide three, where we can look at some other details from the Tomb of the Triclinium, where I have a couple of details of music and dancing. So scenes of dancers occupy the flanking left and right walls. The left wall scene contains dancers, male and female dancers, male musicians playing an ancient instrument similar to like a stringed harp, and common painterly conventions of gender typing are employed. The skin of females is typically lighter in color, and then male figures typically have a darker skin tone of orange brown. The dancers and the musicians, together with the feast, suggest kind of a lighthearted tone to Etruscan funerals. And so this would have been in keeping with ancient Mediterranean customs. Funerals were often accompanied by games, as famously represented by the funeral games of Virgil's epic poem, the Aeneid. That one describes kind of funerals not always being somber, but sometimes being accompanied by lively events. So in the Tomb of Triclinium, we may have an allusion to games as the walls flanking the tomb's entrance bears scenes of youth dismounting horses. We see kind of twins, we see people in action, we see people dancing, which you can see in the image on the bottom right. Also, the image on this slide on the bottom right shows the differences in skin colors. Males, remember, as I told you guys, were kind of like a darker brown color skin tone, and females were always rendered with a lighter skin tone. The tomb of the ceiling also would have been decorated, but typically ceilings received a more kind of geometric stylized pattern. The tomb that you guys are looking at, you can't see it in this picture, but you can go back to slide two and take a look, is painted in a checkered scheme of alternating colors. And so the belief is that probably would have been intended to emulate the fabric of funeral tents that would have been erected near the tomb for the actual celebration of the funerary banquet. The actual paintings were removed from the tombs in 1949, which is why the pictures we have now of the frescoes in the tomb are kind of like poor quality, but they have been preserved. They are deteriorating some areas, but they're still have proven very important for the study of the tomb and the study of Etruscan cultures. All right, so go ahead and move to slide four. We're going to talk about interpretation. So the theme of the Tomb of the Triclinium of being a little bit friendly and lighthearted within the context of a funeral might seem surprising, but it's important to note that Etruscan funeral rites were not somber, they were festive. And the aim of Etruscan funerals was to share one final meal with the deceased before they transitioned into the afterlife. So the ritual feasting served several purposes in social terms. At a very basic level, it helped to mark the transition of the deceased from the world of the living to the world of the dead. Now, we have looked at other cultures that mark the transition from the world of the living to the dead. Think back to the Malangan funerary display and the Tatanua funerary masks utilized in those Malangan ceremonies. Those were intended to move the soul of the deceased from the world of the living to the world of the dead. This is also doing that same thing, but in a different way, in a way that's a little bit more celebratory. So other things that would have happened would be that when the body was put in a tomb, appropriate dishes, utensils for eating and drinking would be put in the tomb. So the idea of that is like the dead would have everything they would need when they move on to the next life. Another purpose of the funeral meal, the games, the other activities, was to reinforce the socioeconomic position of the deceased person. It's a way to remind the community of the living of the importance and standing of the people who passed away and their families, and thus reinforcing their position within society. So this would include, where appropriate, visual reminders of socio-political status, including indications of wealth, civic achievements, and public offices held by the person who would have been deceased. All right, go ahead and move to slide 5. We're going to be taking a look at the Temple of Minerva, which would have been in a city called Veii, which is today in Rome, Italy, and a sculpture that's part of that temple area, a sculpture of Apollo. Okay, let's get started with our next artwork on slide 5. The title of slide 5 is Etruscan temples have largely vanished. How do we know what they look like? So, among the early Etruscans, the worship of gods and goddesses did not take place in or around huge monumental temples as it did with early Greece or in the ancient Near East. Rather, early Etruscans created small ritual spaces in groves and enclosures open to the sky with sacred boundaries carefully marked through ritual ceremony. So around 600 BCE, however, the desire to create more monumental structures for the gods spread throughout Etruria, most likely as a result of interactions with the Greeks and Greek influence. While the desire to create temples for the gods may have been inspired by contact with Greek culture, Etruscan religious architecture was markedly different in both materials and temple design. So Etruscan temples were colorful and ornate structures that typically had stone foundations, but the walls and the roof would have been made out of wood, mud brick, and terracotta. And this would definitely have suffered far more to exposure to the elements. Greek temples still survive today in parts of Greece and southern Italy because they were largely constructed of stone and marble, and Etruscan temples were built with mostly ephemeral materials and have largely vanished. So if Etruscan temples have vanished, how do we know what they even look like? So despite their short-lived nature of their structures, because of the use of wood and mud brick, Etruscan temple design had a huge impact on Renaissance architecture because they were written about by a very famous architect. We'll get to that in a second. And so there are certain elements of Etruscan temple design that we will see in Renaissance structures. There's a certain order of columns known as Tuscan columns, and they look like Doric columns, but they have bases and more details. And the Renaissance structures that we take a look at, we're going to look at Palazzo Rucellai, which is definitely going to utilize that particular order of column. But if Etruscan temples weren't around during the Renaissance era, 15th, 16th centuries in Italy, how did Renaissance era builders know what Etruscan temples look like? So fortunately, there was an ancient Roman architect by the name of Vitruvius who wrote about Etruscan temples in his book De Architectura, and he wrote that book in the late 1st century BCE. Now, the Romans had a lot of respect for the Etruscan cultures, and so they did study their work and write about it, so this wouldn't have been considered unusual. Rome was known for, like, burning cities down and, you know, adding to their empire. But when it came to the Etruscans, they had a respect. And like they learned from the Greeks, they also learned from the Etruscans as well. So in Vitruvius' texts, he describes the key elements of Etruscan temples. And it was his very detailed descriptions that inspired Renaissance architects to return to the roots of Tuscan design and allow archaeologists and art historians to recreate the appearance of these buildings. Go ahead and move to slide 6, where we're going to talk about archaeological evidence for the Temple of Minerva. The archaeological evidence that does remain from many Etruscan temples largely confirms Vitruvius's description. One of the most explored and best known is the temple dedicated to the goddess Minerva at the city of Veii, which is about 18 kilometers north of Rome. For the Romans, Minerva would be the Greek equivalent of Athena. And so we've seen the presence of Athena in much of the architecture that you guys looked at last week. And so Minerva would be that particular equivalent. So this particular temple had a tufa block foundation, and that foundation still remains, and that basically leaves like an Etruscan footprint that helps archaeologists and art historians recreate based on Vitruvius's description, just like Renaissance architects did as well. So the floor plan shows proportions that are 5 to 6. And so, unlike Greek temples, which are perfectly proportional, Etruscan temples are deeper than they are wide. The temple is also roughly divided into two parts, a back porch and a front porch. And there's widely spaced Tuscan columns and a back portion divided into three separate rooms, as you can see on the floor plan on this slide. So this is known as a triple cella. A cella is a room. And these three-room configurations reflect a divine triad associated with the temple, perhaps Minerva as well as Tinia, which would have been associated with Jupiter and Zeus, and another god, Uni, which is associated with Juno or Hera. And so basically, the significance of the three, a sacred number in many religions, but in this case, a sacred arrangement of three important gods and goddesses. So in addition to the internal organization and the materials, what also made Etruscan temples noticeably distinct from Greek ones was they had a high podium and a frontal entrance. So Greek temples you could access from the front, the back, or the sides. It was intended to be kind of like an equal, unified way to enter the temple. You don't do that with Etruscan temples. You only enter from the front. That's a really important difference. Approaching the Parthenon, it would have had a low rising stepped entrance, and it would have been encircled with a forest of columns. That's a very different experience than approaching an Etruscan temple. An Etruscan temple is very high off the ground and has a single defined entrance. Go ahead and move to slide 7, where we're going to talk about the sculpture. And the sculpture does have a connection to that defined entrance. So perhaps the most interesting thing about the Temple of Minerva is its abundant terracotta sculpture that still remains, the volume and quality of which is without parallel all through what would have been ancient Etruria. In addition to the many terracotta architectural elements, masks, decorative details, architectural embellishments, a series of over life-size terracotta sculptures have been discovered, and they've been connected back to this temple. Originally, these sculptures would have been placed at the ridge of the temple roof. And these figures seem to be Etruscan assimilations of Greek gods, set up as a tableau to reenact some kind of mythic event. So, in other words, these sculptures were based off of Greek gods and goddesses, and they are arranged in a way that they like tell a story. So, you'd walk up to a temple, an Etruscan temple, it would have a defined single entrance, and then at the roof of that entrance, you would see all these sculptures that kind of act out a story. So the most famous and well-preserved sculpture is what you're looking at on slide 7. This is a statue of Apollo of Veii. Sometimes, because this is the Etruscan equivalent of Apollo, you'll see it spelled different, like APULU. So just kind of keep in mind you might see that. So here we see a figure that is dynamic. He's striding. It's a masterpiece of large-scale terracotta sculpture. And he's about 5 feet 10 inches tall, which is pretty tall, although that is life size. Typically, more sculptures would be like a few inches shorter than that if they were considered to be life sizes. This is pretty big. His counterpart may have been a figure of Hercules, with whom Apollo struggled with in an epic contest over the Golden Hind, an enormous deer sacred to Apollo's twin sister Artemis. Other figures discovered with these suggest an audience watching the action. Whatever the myth may have been, or whatever story these sculptures may have been intended to be telling, It was a completely Etruscan innovation to use the sculpture in this way, placed at the peak of a temple roof. It would have created a very impressive tableau against the backdrop of the sky, and it would have been a very dramatic entrance to this Greek temple. Sorry, not Greek temple, to this Etruscan temple. Okay, what you guys are going to do next on slide 8 is you guys are going to put your visual analysis skills back to work. Now, keep in mind what I told you guys about visual or formal analysis. Be extra. Be specific. You can never say too much. So that piece is really important. So on slide 8, we are going to be comparing and contrasting classical Greek sculpture, like the famous Doryphorus, with the Etruscan sculpture of Apollo. So what I'd like you guys to do is look at our terms for visual analysis: line, shape, scale, composition, proportion, space, color, light, and texture. And I'd like you guys to talk about some similarities. How are these figures similar? Body position, contrapposto, body lines. Those are probably a lot of things that will help you in this discussion. And then differences. What makes these figures different? I don't expect you guys to use every term, but I think there's two or three that you guys can use really well. And your conversation must talk about contrapposto in some way, shape, or form. Remember I told you guys last week, from here on out, every time we see a sculptural form, we will always talk about the presence of contrapposto or the lack of contrapposto. Then when you finish with slide 8, you're going to be taking a look at the sarcophagus of the spouses, our last Etruscan artwork. And so on slide 9, I'm just going to read this to you guys, and you guys can back up and work on these other pieces. We see an intimacy with this sculpture. We see a loving couple. That's kind of rare to see in some of the art we've looked at so far. So the intimacy of this clay sculpture is unprecedented in the ancient world. What does it tell us about Etruscan culture? So to answer that question, you guys have an ud puzzle. Last time I didn't link this correctly, but this time I did. So on slide 10, you're going to click on the link for period 1 or period 5 and work on that ud puzzle. But before you get to that, make sure you guys back up and finish your short visual analysis for classical Greek sculpture and Etruscan sculpture. All right, and once you finish those pieces, you are done with Etruscan art.